This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Hey, everyone. Just a reminder to tell Joe's mom she looks like she lost weight because I accidentally parked on the grass again.
Hey, guys. Mics are hot. Quiet on the set.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and what are the secrets of geniuses? Unsurprisingly, the secret is, even if you're not a genius yourself, you can learn to act like one. Today, we welcome Dr. Craig Wright to talk about the hidden habits of genius beyond talent, IQ, and grit. Funny, he never called me for his case study. Plus, legendary investor Bill Ackman has an idea that could set everyone in the U.S. up for retirement success, starting at birth. Why wouldn't we want to do this? And if we do it, I said doo-doo, how do us mature guys get back pay? We'll break this down and more during our headline segment. And we'll toss out the Haven Lifeline to a guy with the greatest name in the history of names. What's his name, you say? Well, you gotta listen to find out. What's his question? That much I can tell you. He wants to know about continuing to contribute to a tax-deferred plan, or should he switch to a taxable brokerage account? And of course, I've got some beefy trivia for you. And now, two guys who have a habit of riding my coattails to greatness, it's Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
Imagine where he'd lead if we actually rode his coattails.
There's a difference when between riding one's coattails and being the chariot that you're, you know, that's how I envision it.
In the chariot like, race where you're Ben-Hur.
Yeah. And Doug's the one in front, you know.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to just another Wednesday Open. As usual, that couldn't get weirder. On the Stacky Benjamin Show, I'm Joe Saul, See High Average Show Money on Twitter. The guy who likes to refer to himself as the Ben-Hur of this podcast, it's Mr. OG.
Have you actually seen Ben-Hur?
A long time ago. Like, seriously, I was probably 12.
Yeah. Yeah, so, like, almost. I mean, that's two generations ago.
Easy. That could have been days ago.
Could have been, but it wasn't. Man,
we are starting on fire today. I'm glad that we're starting fast because we got a fantastic guest to keep up with. Craig Wright is going to be on Dad Shortwave today, OG, talking about genius. And I know that while Doug...
Okay, so got that covered.
We're now 3 minutes into the show. Doug's referred to himself as a genius. You've referred yourself to as a genius. Man.
Like attracts like, dude. I don't know what to tell you.
We have no ego problems on this show. Craig Wright going to talk about, if you're not a genius, what are the habits of genius? So maybe you can at least keep up. And I'm sure knowing a little bit about Craig, it's going to be a very, very fun show. But first, before Craig, we've got a couple of very interesting headlines. So let's get the party started.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's headlines.
Our first headline comes to us from MarketWatch. Did you see a couple weeks ago, big hedge fund manager Bill Ackman and his idea?
Remind me.
To save Social Security and other things. Also to solve some of the income gap. Sean Langlois over at MarketWatch wrote this. Bill Ackman on saving capitalism. Every child in the U.S. could be given enough money at birth to become millionaires by retirement. Bill Ackman has an idea for saving the system that made him a billionaire. The Pershing Square Capital Management chairman told investors in a recent note that in order to preserve capitalism, steps need to be taken to close the increasing inequality gap. One possible measure, investment accounts for every child. Under Ackman's plan, each child born in the U.S. would receive $6,750 in a government-funded basket of index funds that could only be tapped at retirement. Assuming 8% returns over 65 years from birth to retirement, that total would ultimately exceed $1 million and would cost the government
$1 million.
And would cost the government about $26 billion a year if the birth rate holds. Compounded returns over time are indeed one of the greatest wonders of the world, and every day we wait to address this issue, the problem looms larger, the hedge fund manager wrote. He added that a government-led push for equities investing accounts could encourage greater financial literacy and spread the stock market's gains across a wider swath of the U.S. population. I read somewhere else, not in this particular piece, that this particular idea would be less onerous on the system than the Social Security program is. Don't know if that's true or not. What do you think, OG?
I would imagine that it would be. I mean, basically, it's the same thing as Social Security, only it's taking your Social Security money and investing it.
This piece doesn't say that he says get rid of Social Security and do this. I have to imagine that if you implemented something like this, something else would have to go, right? So I could easily imagine Social Security.
Yeah, because that's exactly how the government works.
That's right.
The government's all about like eliminating inefficient programs, replacing them with more efficient ones.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. We're going to do this new thing. We got to get rid of something else. No.
The byproduct of it, I mean, on the face of it, replacing Social Security with something like this, you know, I think is super attractive. The problem is that it'll never fly, you know, being a realist. I just think that there's too many people who will oppose it because, you know, the market's volatile and what happens if the market crashes right before you need your money and all that sort of stuff. And then once you layer in all the other special rules, just like Social Security has, well, what happens if you get sick or hurt along the way? What happens if you die? What happens to your money and all that sort of stuff? It's going to look a lot like taking Social Security and just putting it in the market. And I don't remember which feel like it was second Bush.
Yeah.
Kind of floated
I think it was
that
W.
And got destroyed
with the idea. Yeah. You know, what's interesting about this, that this brings up to me is I think about all the people out there that don't have the tools to handle this. Like if there is a way to get that money early, they'll take it mostly because they don't have the tools. They don't understand compounding. And by the way, you know, and when John Hope Bryant was on talking about this, so I'm going to steal his thunder again. And hopefully, by the way, we'll have John back here in a couple of weeks. But John was talking about, you know, these people growing up, you and I have had this discussion as well. Families that didn't get the memo, you know, don't understand how it all works. So I think that this leads to a deeper conversation about why aren't we spending more time? I know that financial literacy programs in schools have been notoriously bad. Like the real reason we don't have more of that is that you do studies on efficacy of those programs and it's horrible. But why don't we focus on the financial literacy programs that are working and make that more widespread? I feel like if we gave people more tools to work with, I think there would be less fear around the market. Because I'm with you, OG. I think there's so much fear around investing that it's very easy to sell people on, no, oh, you know, all the bad things that could happen if we did that.
Well, being a little bit of a cynic here, I don't think that that's the American way, man. The two competing pressures here are consumerism and being financially responsible. A lot of times you can't have both. You know, you can't buy the brand new Lexus for Christmas. By the way, the commercials are starting. It's the holiday season event because you're only good if you give the person you care about a new car with a bow on it.
Did you see, I think it was Janine in our basement Facebook group who shared a Facebook message from her aunt about her uncle had surprised her aunt with a brand new car.
I've shot for cars before on a side note. It is nothing that you just like go, you know what I think Joe would like? A tan interior.
How pissed would Mrs. OG be? if you just brought her home a car.
That I've actually done that and it didn't work. We got when my second kid was born, we went out and we were like, okay, we can't do the whole like two small sedan thing. We need a bigger vehicle because the car seats just simply didn't fit in the back of this car. And we, you know, far be it from us to go buy smaller car seats. That's not a solution. No, we need a bigger vehicle. One that you pour gas in one end and it comes out the other. And like she would tell you, I mean, she'd probably a week post baby. I come rolling in the driveway and I'm like, hey, what do you think about this? And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I think this should be yours. And she's like, yeah, whatever, dude. And she's like, the first time she drove it was sat in the driveway for 3 weeks before she got out of the house because she had just had a baby. And she liked it, but nevertheless, it was
not a great idea.
But now, so back to the original point here, consumerism and being financially responsible are two separate things. And the power of consumerism, the power of marketing, the power of the economy, right? The whole thing is predicated on people spending money like crazy. So the reason that financial literacy doesn't work is because there's too many people who are against it.
There's too many people depending on people getting in financial trouble.
Well, and maybe not even financial trouble per se, but would be happy with you just spending everything you made. Like, I'm okay with you not having to go into debt over this, but as long as you spent everything, I'm good if I'm the CEO of Disney or Gillette or GM.
Remember when Nick from Magnified Money was on and was, because he used to work before he did Magnified Money, used to work for one of the big credit card companies. I believe he worked for Citi and Barclay. But he said that the magic disgusting sauce of a credit card company was finding those people who had a good enough credit score to get the card and good enough habits to pay the bill every month, but bad enough habits that they kept that card completely maxed out all the time.
All the time. Yeah,
that's what they want. They don't want a default, but they also don't want the person who's paying off the card every month. Like the key person was the person that you're talking about.
Like 70% full on the card, barely making the minimum payments, but is smart enough not to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, 30 days.
Yeah. Later. That person they call in all caps profit margin.
Yeah. A platinum client. So I think that part of the problem with all of this is that there's too many forces acting against it. And maybe not from a nefarious standpoint, not from the like purposefully trying to derail it.
Maybe
but
though.
Just think about the messaging that's on the TV and stuff.
That part is nice, but now I'll be the cynical one. So here, yes. Let me take the baton. Because Bill Ackman loves this partly because he's an investor dude, right? More people invest
in put $26 billion back into the market every year. That's going to.
Right. Everybody's got a point of view. His point of view is investing is good. Investing made me a bunch of money. It can make you a bunch of money, too. So even though it probably doesn't profit him straight away, having more potential clients that he can manage money for, not a bad thing from where he sits. However, I tend to like his idea. I also tend to think that, like you, it will never fly. And I also think that people don't have enough tools to make it fly. Not enough people listening to Stacking Benjamins, dude. That's the big problem. That is the big problem. Hey, but I'll tell you who isn't a problem. These people that trade stocks, these day traders, those people are the key to the whole system. I don't know if you know that, OG. All you got to do is just trade a few stocks and your life is fantastic. Did you know that?
Yeah. That's what the internet
How about says. This? This is a TikTok video. I just found. This is from TikToker Thomas Crallo. Check this out.
A day in the life of any stock trader. Get up. Turn on my trading station and make some money. Get in a Lamborghini. Drive to a really nice beach club. Have some fantastic lunch. Do some wakeboarding. And then buy some Louis Vuitton and shop for some nice watches. And finally, polish it all with some mild street racing.
Isn't that the way you live your life? Wake up.
Precisely.
Make some money. Takes about 30 minutes, maybe 45 if you're having a bad day. head out for a super nice lunch in your Lamborghini, buy some Louis Vuitton.
Make some money.
Easy.
I feel bad. We were having a discussion about this morning, and not quite this bad, but about bloggers who make a ton of money selling this dream that's a bunch of crap, right? Working 50 hours selling people that being retired is awesome, and you can be like me, but I'm not really as awesome as you think I am, because all the stuff,
festival.
All the stuff that I'm doing that I'm selling you on so I make more money is just, just fantastic. And don't get me wrong. I mean, to some degree, the investing area of iTunes, of YouTube, and of all these channels is going to lure in somebody who's hoping for the shortcut, right? They're hoping for that magic thing that's finally going to solve all the problems with the fact that there's nothing inside their soul.
Well, the magic sauce is time. It just is. That's the winner.
No,
time.
No. The magic sauce is, I think is clearly this.
In a life of any stock trader, get up, turn on my trading station and make some money. Get
that's the key.
Lamborghini.
Get a Lamborghini. Get Lamborghini.
A really nice beach club.
Go to lunch at a nice beach
club. Fantastic lunch. Do some wakeboarding.
Go do some wakeboarding. It solves all your problems.
Louis Vuitton and shop for some nice watches.
Because who would buy watches at a place that costs less than Louis Vuitton? What am I? Uncivilized? I'm sure this guy's never had a bad day in his life.
I can tell.
That's so good. Thanks to whoever pointed that out to me. I have no idea anymore, but it's brilliant. Just absolutely brilliant. I think that is takeaway number one. Go do some wakeboarding. More wakeboarding.
Probably would solve a lot of problems, actually. just going outside and like detaching yourself from a lot of stuff for a while. Probably not a bad idea.
I've had those days.
That could be like code from now on, like in our Slack channel. Yeah, I'm going wakeboarding. It's like I'm out of here.
That should be ours. And then our second takeaway, Bill Ackman's idea. Glad he's adding to the conversation. I think we need more conversations like that. Not sure this one's going anywhere, but great conversation. If you've ever read about the philosophy called flow, you know that one of the primary study groups when it came to looking at flow were musicians. So it didn't surprise me when I found that the author of a book about genius is, of course, a professor of music at Yale University. Dr. Craig Wright is a Guggenheim Fellow. He's received an honorary doctorate of human letters from the University of Chicago. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was awarded the Sewell Prize for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching at Yale. And you're about to see why people think he's a great teacher. He certainly is a gentleman who has taught me a lot in the short amount of time that I've been able to spend with him. He holds a Bachelor of Music degree from Eastman School of Music, and his PhD is from Harvard University. He also won the Devane Medal for Excellence in Teaching and Scholarship in 2018. And in 2020, he's our guest on the Stacking Benjamin Show. Here to talk about genius, let's say hello to Dr. Craig Wright. And my dad, Shortwave Radio, it's our new friend, Dr. Craig Wright. How are you, man?
I'm great. I'm glad to be here and talk about genius. I should say at the outset, I'm no genius. And my kids, they think that this is the funniest darn thing they've ever heard. What? You plotter? You're writing a book on genius? This cannot be. But in any event, here I am, and we're talking about it.
Yeah, but you're not interested. You're not so interested, Craig, that you're interested to write a book, but you also taught classes on genius.
Yeah, I love this expression, have the boldness of ignorance. In other words, you get out there and you try whatever you think you might be able to do. God forbid if you actually know what you're doing, because then you probably won't go there. So you've got to get out beyond your ken, I think. And that's the way you discover things. And that's the way you make yourself a better and more interesting person.
I want to ask you about the, well, before I get to the history of genius, let's sit down in your class. Pretend that all of us stackers, Craig, we're your classroom for today. And it's the very first day of our genius class. Yeah. Where do you begin your class with a new group of people thinking about genius?
I love that. I love that question. I think to get people to open up and be creative, you've got to make things funny. You got to make people laugh. So my first gambit to them is, and on a good semester, I have 100 and 120 kids in front of me. Okay, here we are. How many of you are a genius? Please raise your hand if you're a genius. Please raise your hand. And they look around, what is this guy crazy? And then gradually, well, not sometimes so gradually, some of the class clowns will immediately raise their hand and say, yeah, me over here. And then the person next to them starts nudging and on it goes. And that's an opening gambit that works. And then at the end of the course, I come back and ask the same question. No kidding. The last session of the class, ask the same question. Now who wants to be a genius? And virtually nobody raises their hands, which is an odd phenomenon.
Yeah. Why is that? Do we find that genius over the years, as we define it more, makes you more of an outcast, an outlier? Why is that?
Yeah. Because to cut to the chase here, in a word, because they're mostly bastards. They're very unpleasant people. They're so self-centered. Now, look, we need these people. They're the people that change the world. They're the people that have the capacity to make the world better by being creative. But they are so focused. They are so passionate. They're so obsessive about what they're doing that they leave a lot of collateral damage in the way of their partners, spouses, husbands, wives, children, colleagues, et cetera, et cetera. It's all about me. And so we have to take one for the team. We being the populace in general, we take one because we put up with these very unpleasant, for the most part, very unpleasant people. There are a few exceptions, need to say, but generally speaking, they're obsessive, self-referential, and not good team players.
It's funny. There's a quote I read a long time ago, and I'm not going to get who it was that said, it's the cracked ones who let in the light for the rest of us. I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, that's true. That's a great play on words, too. The cracked ones. Yes, they're mentally cracked. And there's this little crack. The insight can sneak through and a little bit of new light comes into our lives.
So when we look at the history of genius, because I know we throw around genius, you'll watch golf and they'll say that was a genius shot or you know, tennis, that was a genius stroke. But the history of genius, walk me through, I guess, a very abbreviated history of genius, because it seems like while we throw it around a lot now, genius, when it comes to thinking about this all time, fairly new thing. I mean, what, Middle Ages, we start talking about genius, Renaissance, maybe?
Well, actually, it goes all the way back to classical antiquity, and they had a notion of genius back there, too. And there's a Greek word for it that comes very close to mania. In other words, these are people that are sort of crazy at the outset. They have a mania for doing a particular thing. So it's a different sort of notion with the Greeks and Romans, though. The funniest way of, the most interesting way of thinking of this is that a genius was sort of a genie that sat on your shoulder, and that you would ask that genie to do wonderful things for you in the course of the year. Was this external force that was going to direct you, like Aladdin, Walt Disney Aladdin or whatever. Every time, Joe, when's your birthday?
February, mid-February.
Okay, next time you're there, or last time you were there, did your wife bake you a cake or anybody bake you a cake?
Yes, although if we had candles, we would have burnt the house down. So no candles anymore on my cakes.
Well, when you were doing that, did you realize, Joe, that you were reenacting an ancient ritual in which you are doing offering a votive prayer to your genius? This, you make a wish. Well, it's a votive offering to your genie that genie will do wonderful things for you in the course of the year. So that's the way back in the day, Greek and Roman times, that's the way it used to be. We get our notion of genius really in the Enlightenment. And it's a fascinating thing. And I know your show is interested in money too. But our modern notion of genius comes in during the Enlightenment. And it's mostly in France, somewhat in Germany, and particularly in England. All right, so we go to England in the 18th century. What else is happening in England in the 18th century? Well, they're forming all of these, in a sense, offshore venture capital risky schemes. They're sending groups out to the New World. They knew about the New World, hadn't known about the New World for a couple of centuries, but they're sending people out there to colonize and to exploit the natural resources. And they need money for this. And this, of course, is the advent of capitalism in a very aggressive form. So it's not incidental that what we think of as genius and this idea of you can go out there and you can make it and you deserve to keep what you make, you sort of the eat what you kill mentality is coming into Western thought at this particular time. The whole notion of genius is really a Western idea, and it meshes particularly well. It maps particularly well on the ethos or the principles involved in capitalism in Western countries, particularly, I think, in England. Adam Smith, you know far more about this than I do.
Well, but this idea, to your point, this idea then to create and to manifest and to make more then spurs more people toward finding their genius?
I think it does. And that's one of the really interesting ironies of this. Let me continue your question just a second, Joe, and then we'll try to loop back to this idea of capitalism and money here. So that's where we are in the 18th century. The genius is an exceptional person who has within himself, not the genie. The genie's gone off the shoulder here, and forget about the God, the Christian God, the Judaic God. It is now inside of ourselves here.
So we've kind of taken it, not to cut you off, Craig, but we've taken it now from divine, right? The time of antiquity, taking it from divine to I have this inside of me.
Right. And it's at this point that the whole idea of intellectual property comes to the fore, and copyright law, and philosophers start talking about intellectual property, and people start writing this down in various copyright provisions that get put into British common law, and eventually at the end of the 18th century into copyright law and patents in the United States. So it's all working together. Then in the 19th century, it goes a little bit crazy because we begin to get this idea that genius is this somewhat insane loner who's lurching around and suddenly slaps his forehead and says, with eureka, I got this great idea. And that's sort of almost the Hollywood or the comic book character genius, and they start to dress the part and on it goes. And that's sort of where we are today, kind of a mixture of this, you know, you eat what you kill individualism with the genius from the Enlightenment and the crazy, slightly offbeat, loner, idiosyncratic figure from the Romantic period.
I think that's why many of us just roll our eyes whenever Elon Musk tweets anything.
but it comes with the
territory, is what you're saying.
But thank God. I mean, where would I be writing this book and needing a modern figure, a modern poster boy for genius? It's Elon Musk. Do we like Elon Musk? What do you think, Joe? Do you hear everybody? Is he a warm and fuzzy guy?
He is controversial, to say the least, I'd say.
Yeah. But from what I read, is he a good family fellow? Is he home there with the kids every night, helping cook to dinner, doing the homework, cleaning up the dishes?
Not great for his family. Not great. Well, the woman who worked with him for years, right? I mean, he unceremoniously let her go a few years ago after being his right-hand woman forever.
Right. Yeah. And we read about it, how he treats his employees. And so he is the prototype, in a sense, in modern terms, of the genius. But my God, what he's able to come up with, and not just, and this is what I like about it, it's not in the silo of one particular industry. He's out there sequentially in four or five separate, seemingly unrelated industries, but he's able to pull them all together, where it's his boring company, or whether it's Solar City, or whether it's Tesla, or whether it's SpaceX. It's the Renaissance polymath with the same kind of 18th and 19th century you eat what you kill mentality.
I feel like, you know, when we talk about Elon Musk, or we talk about any of the great geniuses that you talk about in your book, a mentor of mine once talked about the power of being five, that a five-year-old isn't looking for that next cost of living raise or to move from assistant to the manager up to assistant manager, these little tiny increments. They want to be a firefighter or the president. Like they're thinking in these big terms. Is that genius?
Yeah, I think it is. And I have a whole chapter in my book. At least I got to open it up to remember. Let me go back and see what's in my book here, Joe. No kidding. Okay, chapter four. Imagine the world as does a child. And there's this term that goes along with it, neoteny. One of the things that you can do. Do you have children, Joe?
I do. I've got twins who are 25.
So you've been through all this, and you did you ever say to them, "Oh, grow up"?
Oh, never. Come on. Of course. Like about every other 4 hours.
Yes. Well, it turns out that's the worst thing we can say to children. Oh, grow up. You should say, "Oh, don't grow up," because the children, they don't know what the boundaries are to their imagination and all the things that can be thought of in this world. And I'm sure you've got your own particular story. How in the world did they think of? Could she thought of that? You know, at age 4 or 5. It's because we as parents put them in these straitjackets, in these barriers behind bars of you should behave this way and you should say this and this is acceptable. That's crazy. You couldn't possibly do that. And all. So over time, we shut down that childlike imagination. So I'm with you. I don't know if you feel this way, but in retrospect, that's one of the things in writing this book. You learn stuff. I now have 7 grandchildren. And of course, with children, you're just trying to avoid chaos. But with grandchildren, you kind of watch it all. Say, hey, this is really cool. What's going on here? And you see that maybe you should allow them to sneak over there and get into stuff. So with the grandchildren, you're encouraging them to get into stuff where with the children, you're trying just to lay down the law, in effect.
Well, then for genius, what role then does curiosity play? Because I would have to think if you talk about genius in kids and in the way that they play, curiosity must play a huge role.
Right. It does. And in this book, I articulate, I think, 14 different things that you can do or personal traits or hidden habits that you can have to be a genius. I'll tell you what my number one is, and I'll tell you what my most overrated is. Let me start with the most overrated. That's so-called IQ or smarts. Because to say it simply here, we're just testing on these tests. It's essentially quantitative reasoning and verbal skills. And it's testing one type of knowledge, whereas in music and art and choreography and in political science, dealing with other people and political systems and politics and et cetera, it involves many other sorts of skills.
Are you saying the IQ test maybe test one type of genius or it really misses the ball altogether?
I think thank you very much for clarifying that. You're absolutely right. It's important, but all that's important is have a good general IQ. And to quantify it here, I would say maybe an IQ of 115 to 120. Once you get to that level, you're in the game. Thereafter, it's all kind of vanity points.
All right. So is there any better way to measure genius? Like, you know, kids take SAT to get into college?
There is. The problem is there's a reason these are standardized tests. They have to be standardized because you got so many kids to treat. Think of China. They have this Gaokao. You know, they may have 5 million people or maybe 50. I don't know. 50 million people take it in a single year. How many hundreds of thousands take the SAT? So we can't be individualizing or test out particular characteristics that take a long time to evaluate. My favorite go-to person here is Charles Darwin. You know, he's arguably one of the most influential scientists of all time. 5 years, he went around the world in the Beagle. And what he demonstrated was, well, he's got great curiosity. He's great persistence. He's got resilience. He's got capacity for scientific observation. But your test for Darwin would have to go on about 5 years. We only got 3 from 9 to noon here in our SAT test. So we got a problem, Houston.
So IQ's the most overrated one. What's the first one?
The most important one to have, because I'm beginning to see now, Joe, that you are, in fact, a genius, is exactly what you articulated, curiosity. And I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said, if at birth you as a mother could give your child one personal characteristic, it would be curiosity. And I do think that that is true. These people are relentlessly curious. Here's the other crazy thing. They don't learn well in school. They're not necessarily Phi Beta Kappa types at all. And their grade point averages are not the best, but they are relentlessly curious because they are always learning and they are always teaching themselves. They're autodidacts and they learn for a lifetime. That's the most important thing that you can learn in college. It's the one thing that they never teach you in college. How to teach yourself, how to learn by yourself. And if you're curious and learn how to learn for yourself, the road is open for you to follow and off you go.
Well, so what's the difference? I mean, you are a gentleman who's taught in higher education for a long time. Is it the ability to design their own curriculum that their curiosity can take them beyond the current syllabus? What's the why does higher ed not work for many geniuses?
Because higher ed is in the silo of higher ed. And this pandemic is revealing some of the chinks in the armor. And if we really look deeply, the emperor has, the educational emperor has no clothing. It's something of a scam. It's something of a labor protection racket in a way, because I had to smile when you mentioned the word curriculum. Try to get through a curriculum change. I had the honor, the last thing that I was doing at Yale, when I started to get frustrated with lots of things, was I was given the position Academic Director of Online Education. I said, this is really cool. We're going to set up online education because we can get it free and out all around the world. We may need it in particular circumstances. It can bring us all together. You try telling an entrenched faculty in an Ivy League school that, hey, we're going to start doing this a different way, and it's not going to involve you standing up on a stage in front of a classroom. Good luck with that.
Back to genius then. Is genius nature or nurture?
That's a good question. You know, you asked me, Joe, at the beginning of this, what do you do in your first day of the classroom? And we talked about that opening gambit. The last gambit, that opening day, I have all the kids stand up and I start chanting. There is no answer. There is no answer. There is, come on, louder, louder. There is no, and suddenly the room is rocking. There is, and then somebody says, well, what's the question? Okay, the question is it nature or nurture? I really want to get across that point. There's still, and people have been riffing on this now for 200 years, is it a natural gift or is it what you do with yourself through hard work? I have some opinions about that. I have asked some interesting people about that, and I could read you. You know, one of the kids in my class, no kidding, is the number one American figure skater. His name is Nathan Chen. Nathan Chen, an Olympic medal winner already. Of course, he's sort of on the sidelines because the Olympics are on the sidelines at the moment. We may not have time for this. What do you think? You want to hear what he had to say?
Of course we have. Are you kidding me? How do you start a sentence with, hey, we have this Olympic figure skater guy who's phenomenal at what he does. Oh, let's not talk about it.
Yeah. Well, he's brilliant because we were doing this class online in the summer and he was always calling in from a car somewhere. He was sometimes in Vancouver, sometimes in Tokyo, sometimes he's in Japan training here and there, but he was always on the ball. So, and I've asked him before I started talking about this book, because he's a Yale student and I can't just go use his name and things without his permission. So this is what Nathan wrote, and with his permission. This is Nathan Chen, America's number one ranked figure skater. In my opinion, there are genetic factors, so that's nature, at work in this domain. Height, bodily proportions, general strength, and the capacity to quickly improve muscle memory. But there are, in addition, a number of genetic factors that you can't really see that are more difficult to quantify. Among these are the ability to be calm in the face of stress and the ability to internalize and strategize over the course of a competition. I'm going to stop right there, Joe, because in my life, and maybe even talking with you today, I could not do what Nathan is urging me to do, to calm down and control my stress. And that's why I failed as a concert pianist, because I couldn't control that stress on the stage. But Nathan has the ability to do that. And then to course correct during a competition, well, you've got to really, you know, we've got to think clearly. And I'm usually so bouncing around here. So, and how do you do that when you're in the air doing a quadruple flip or turn, as those folks do? Okay. So I would say for me that it is 80% in nature. He says it's 80% gifts. The gold medal athletes, they get to the accumulated 100% nature, 80% nature, genes and luck, and 20% nurture. So in his mind, it's mostly a natural gift. For those athletes who are at 60 in terms of nature, they must maximize the 20% of the work in order to even think about competing against the top, those at the 90 to 100% level.
I think that's a very powerful statement, because if most of us listening to this show, if we recognize, like most of the students in your class, that we aren't genius, using that nurture part as much as we can becomes so, so important. Being more curious, looking at the world differently, differentiating, trying to slow down your stress, like you talked about, like focusing on those things becomes incredibly important.
Yeah. And I think we all can. I mean, you know, when I started out doing this, the last thing I wanted to do is write one of these how-to books. You know, you see them, the gazillions, hundreds of thousands, you can change your life if you do this. And I'm supposed to be a bona fide academic here, and my colleagues are going to run over me with a bread truck or something. But after thinking through all of this and working through all of this, you know, darn it, you really can change yourself. And I know that I have changed myself. There's certain things that I do now that I would never have done before. There's certain ways that I think about failure, this whole idea to think about failure as an opportunity. Oprah Winfrey has talked a lot about that. It's just an opportunity opening another door for you here. But be more patient. You have to be more, when things aren't going well, you really have to sit there and be patient with it and work through that particular problem, because you'll probably learn a lot. If everything goes well, you're never going to learn anything. So having obstacles really proves to be an advantage. I could go on and on about how you can set up a creative lifestyle, but it would take us probably take more time than we got, right?
Well, I do have an important follow-up question on what you just said, because I think it's so powerful for people. But I think another piece of genius is knowing when this is going nowhere. And for every person who's a recognized genius out there, there's got to be hundreds who have worked on something forever and ever and ever, and nothing came of it. So when does genius end and crazy Don Quixote behavior begin?
Well, good for you. I mean, that is a great question. And it brings us to the sunk cost moment. And it's exactly that point. And I think all creative spirits, all those folks that are out there taking risks that really do have a valuable new idea, are constantly beset by self-doubt. Is this really going to work? But you may have so much into it that you cannot possibly believe, or you cannot possibly believe that this isn't going to work, and it's too expensive to go backwards. I mean, it's your whole life, your whole personality, who you are, wrapped up in this venture. But that is a critical moment, the critical moment. Now, the only way around that is to be one of these polymaths. And I want to go to Thomas Edison here. Because Thomas Edison had a lot of things going for him. You know, he had motion pictures, phonograph, electric light bulb, and a lot of other things that people don't know about. But he had two it doesn't work moments, and they were painful. Let's talk about direct current. We won't talk about that at length, but you know about Tesla and alternating current and Edison. And he went deeply, literally, into the ground on direct current and spent a huge amount of money, ultimately lost control of what was Edison Electric that became General Electric, the financier J.P. Morgan, and so on, gradually diluted the shares of stock. They came to control it, and out went Edison. Okay, direct current is one of them. The other was, get this, ore mining, iron ore mining in New Jersey. Where? What? Are you kidding me? So he's got this because he wants to extract valuable metals out of iron ore. And well, at that moment, where's the biggest pile of iron ore? It happened to be up near where President Trump's Bedminster Country Club, Tony Bedminster Country Club, is up there in the northwest portion of New Jersey. He spends 5 years doing this, but the amount of pure metals that he's getting out of this ore as he's trying to smelt it and separate it is so minuscule that he's not making any money at it. And he sticks with this for 5 years. And eventually he throws in the towels and goes into something goofy, seemingly goofy, like prefabricated cement houses. Why? Because they had discovered high-grade iron ore by more than the tons in Minnesota, and it could be shipped through the Great Lakes up, you know, along the canal system and into the smelting factories of particularly Cleveland and Pittsburgh. Even the geniuses don't always hit a home run. Sometimes, like Babe Ruth, he whiffed a lot more times than he hit a four-bagger.
Well, and baseball is a perfect analogy, I think, because you can, you know, bat 300. You can be unsuccessful 700, yeah, you know, right, 70% right. of the time and still be great.
Every 10 times you get out there, seven of them, you look like a fool.
I have 50 more questions, but I'm going to end with this one. When I prep for interviews and to all of our friends hanging out with us listening, this is a little pull back the curtain. What I like to do first before I dive into books is I just kind of skim and look for interesting stories. And it's so funny. There is a chapter here that really caught my eye. And after reading it, I think it's probably the best place for us to end, which is you have a chapter in here called Find Your Missing Piece. And I thought this was so powerful. Can you tell us what that means and how that's relevant to genius?
You know, it's funny that you should mention that, Joe, because I was talking about these grandchildren. And just last night, we sat down with and we used Zoom and we read a bedtime story with this last grandchild. It was Shel Silverstein's The Missing Piece. We go through it and we go to the end of it. Actually, I'd read her this story before. So this was the second time that we had done this. The grandmother, my beloved wife, Sherry, and I. I remember the first time she didn't seem to like the book all that much. And the second time, I can't say that it was a hit either. So why not? Why not? And then at the end of it, we ask her, well, what did that book mean? What did that book mean? Then we had to think, well, couldn't chase the butterfly anymore, couldn't talk to the worm, couldn't sing with the birds, couldn't roll along smoothly. All the great, the thing that we love doing is experiencing all these things as we do them. Once we get them, well, now what do we do? And that is my great dilemma in life at this particular moment. I've written this book that I've worked on for The Hidden Habits of Genius now for 15 years. I'm at the end of this process. What's my next act? I got to figure out something, because that next act is what's going to keep me alive. It's going to keep me passionate. It's keep me obsessed. And it's going to keep me going.
The book is The Hidden Habits of Genius: Beyond Talent, IQ, and Grit, Unlocking the Secrets of Greatness. I had so much fun diving into this. Craig, it's available everywhere?
Absolutely. Amazon and all of your other vendors. Yep.
Awesome.
HarperCollins, wonderful people to work with.
They are great people. By the way, they're people that we work with on making the podcast. Just fantastic group of people over there.
Yeah, they are.
Well, thanks for hanging out with us and talking genius and Shel Silverstein.
It was fun. It didn't seem like in retrospect, this is no assignment. Gee, we should do this all the time. This is fun. I love a good conversation. Thanks so much, Joe.
Trivia fans, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And now that we've unlocked our collective geniuslessness, thanks to Craig Wright, I actually just discovered that one of the most consequential drugs ever was genetically engineered on today's date back in 1982. Can't believe I'm learning about this thing called human growth hormone for the first time. Apparently, one or two baseball guys have used it, I guess. And today, this genius brain of mine is coming up with some strategic uses for this HGH stuff. But before I spill the beans, why don't I first let you flex on today's trivia? Speaking of baseball and HGH, when batters enter the batter's box, they end up with a batting average. Well, fund managers also have a batting average. What word is used to describe if a fund manager is able to outperform the index they're competing against? I'll be back faster than you can go back, 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 and long gone.
I'm a little jealous, OG.
I understand. Geniuses do tend to intimidate.
Jordan Harbinger just had Ray Dalio on.
Never heard of him.
No idea who that is. We should go get Bill Ackman to talk about his strategy. It is so interesting, not just with him, but with many of the guests that Jordan has on. It's easy to subscribe to his show, jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. It's a podcast that when you're done with us, you should definitely check out, because you're a fan of high quality, fascinating podcast hosted by interesting geniuses like OG. Jordan's show covers a wide range of topics through weekly interviews with heavy hitting guests. There's a ton of episodes rooted in the business and tech space. Not only do you want to check out Ray Dalio, but after you've listened to our interview with Guy Raz, Jordan's interview with Guy is a good 1-2 punch. I thought very interesting, quirky, and weird. My custody battle with an escort ex. That one, very, very strange. Jack Barsky, deep undercover with a KGB spy in America. That one had me for the entire 54 minutes. And Chris Hadfield talking about an astronaut's guide to life on Earth. He always has interesting people. I really love not just the Jordan Harbinger show, but I'm a big fan of Jordan. I love some of the email exchanges that he and I have back and forth. He's been a guy who's helped us a ton on this podcast, and he's always very giving of his time. You can tell from his Q&A episodes, Jordan is very much a giving guy. All you got to do when you're done with us, search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, or just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. And you'll see all the links to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. Check it out.
Hey, trivia fans. It's your soon-to-be, new and improved, Joe's Mom's Neighbor Doug. Why do you ask? Well, here's the deal. While I'm certainly a genius, I'm only 6 foot tall, which is certainly nothing to complain about given my rugged good looks, but I've always thought that 6'2"-ish with chiseled guns is more statuesque for a man of my stature. Had I known about this miracle drug HGH earlier, I would have already had both the brains and the brawn this podcast deserves. Well, time to go find me some HGH, but before I do, let's get back to today's trivia. The question was, when batters enter the batter's box, they end up with a batting average. Duh. Fund managers also have a batting average. What word is used to describe if a fund manager is able to outperform the index they're competing against? When a fund manager creates additional return for shareholders, that is referred to as alpha. Now that that's out of the way, it's time for me to go get swole, yo. See ya.
Big thanks to Dr. Craig Wright for coming down to the basement. You know, OG, maybe you are onto something. As you heard, geniuses are bad in school. So maybe you are one.
I was actually pretty good in school.
Oh, then you're screwed. No. you are screwed. Yes. But there's the other part that, you know, I also loved him saying that geniuses are largely bastards, and that kind of fits the bill for you. So you're like halfway there, man.
Right.
I do like the idea, though, that you have to stay curious. And you and I have talked about this just with your financial plan, that retirement's not the end, right? Putting yourself out to pasture isn't the end. Geniuses are people who are naturally curious. And also, if everybody's looking over to the right, just naturally going, well, what does the left look like? And also thinking in big pictures. I love all those themes. I think even if you're not searching for genius, just searching for a more fulfilling life.
Yeah, get out of the day-to-day stuff and look beyond it a little bit.
It is so fun. I think that's what I enjoy most. You know, you're the one that introduced me to Strategic Coach. And that's what I enjoy most about Strategic Coach.
It only took 10 years for you to sign up.
getting out of the day-to-day and thinking about your life in much, much bigger terms. I like that. If you're not spending time doing that a little bit and thinking about why am I here, I think you're missing out on some big opportunities. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline and tackle some of life's most important questions. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency put what you value first.
I'm starting to think about Halloween costumes. So, yep. What to be.
You're not just going to go the way that we said before, just go pop on a mask. No, this is it. This is my costume.
This is it. Yeah.
Dead during COVID. That's my costume.
That's what you're going for?
Yeah. I'm trying to lose a bunch of weight so I can gain it all on the 31st. That's my goal.
And from like the 31st through the 1st of January, right? I mean, because once that kicks off, you got candy. And then like 3 weeks later, you eat like a slob. And then there's like a whole week of leftovers. And then you get like 2 weeks to get your crap back together. And then it's like all the holiday stuff and New Year's and yeah.
Wait till you see the new house that we bought. It is on the top of a big effing hill. So I'm fairly certain that we're not going to have much when it comes to trick or treaters, but that's not going to stop me from getting like, I always make sure
that at the bottom of the hill, stay at the bottom of the hill with the little table,
make those little runts come up.
Come I was up wondering where you're going to go with that.
I should put on that, Toy Story Army Man Sarge mask up the hill, soldier.
Little hill, no sweat.
You want that Hershey bar? Up the hill, up the hill. It says that at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they put what you value first, your loved ones and your time. But I certainly like Halloween. Of course, Halloween with your loved ones every year. That's always fun to do with the kids and see it through the kids' eyes. That's a good one. Spend time with your kids getting ready for Halloween and not filling out life insurance paperwork, especially when you can do it all online. They've streamlined the entire process. You can get a free quote right away. Head to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life now. Today, we're going to throw out the lifeline to that gentleman who Doug said had the best name on earth. Let's throw out the lifeline to Doug.
Hi, Joe and OG. I found your show a few months back and have been entertained, educated, and motivated by you folks. Wait, I'm not supposed to say the part about being educated, right? Oh, well. I do have a question for you two, and it deals with investing in a governmental 457B plan. I teach at a public college and have a mandatory pension plan in addition to a 457B account. Sadly, there's no Roth version. Additionally, I will receive Social Security, which I plan to take at 70. Here's my question. Since my tax bracket in retirement will probably be the same as it is now, should I stop contributing to the 457B plan and start investing that money in a taxable account, such as a total stock index fund? Thanks again for making a show that makes me want to replace something every episode. Doug. No, not that Doug, but another one. Thanks.
No wonder Doug wanted to be affiliated with Doug. Doug is a college professor, and that I think is who neighbor Doug would love to be. Thanks for the kind words, Doug. Sorry that you learned something listening to the show. Glad we can entertain you. But I think this is an important thing. The idea of putting money in this 457 plan, which there are some key differences, Doug, between a 457, not just for Doug, but for everybody else, between a 457 and a 401k. However, for people listening, the way we're going to treat it is largely like the same thing as a 401k, but for people that work in the public sector. So sometimes a 401k is not available, 457 is. So just a little translation, OG, for people that might, what the hell is a 457? Think 401k for now, a little different, but I think you're good for this argument. What do you think? Should he stop putting money in and put it in a more flexible spot?
I think that the biggest thing with all of this is to make sure that you've got some tax diversification. You know, we don't have any idea what tax brackets are going to look like 10, 20, 30 years from now. We don't know what they're going to look like in 10 months from now, frankly. But the reality is that it's going to be a good idea to have a little bit of everything. There's no way to know what the outcome is going to be until you actually get to the outcome, you know? So you may find out at 70, like, ah, son of a gun, I should have put all of this in pre-tax because they stopped taxing retirement distributions. Who knows? But you don't know that. So you have to have a little bit of balance. And I would say that if you look across your investment accounts and you see, you know, we talk about tax triangle, three different places you can put your money, pre-tax, after-tax, or after-tax that comes out tax-free, right? So basically Roth brokerage and pre-tax 401k. And if you look at that and you say, well, I'm going to draw circles and weight them out based on how much money is in each one, you want them to be pretty balanced. And if you've got a whole bunch of money in pre-tax and very little money in after-tax, I think you should start considering some money on the after-tax. That being said, I don't know that I'm a big fan of just throwing away tax deductions that are there just because you just don't feel like capturing them that day. there's some benefit to the fact that if you're contributing to your 403B and maxing that out, and then you're contributing to a 457 and maxing that out, you could be putting $39,000 to $52,000 away, depending how old you are, completely without paying income taxes on that. And that's pretty attractive also, because it opens up opportunities for other things. So it's a unique situation, but I think you got to weigh out both of those variables, balancing potential future unknowns versus the bird in the hand, you know, getting the tax deduction today.
Yeah. I think about something else too, which is a lot of the time when people decide that they're going to save outside of the 401k or 457 in this case, and they back things down, not for Doug. I think Doug will follow through on his plan, but you know what happens, OG? People are like, well, I'm going to slow this down and I'm going to pick this up, but you know what I'm going to do? I got this thing I got to do right now. I'm just going to wait two paychecks and then I'll start again. And then you never do.
Yep.
Saving outside of your workplace plan is way harder than saving inside your workplace plan, because the money leaves your hands before it even touches your hand. So making it automated, I think, is a big, big piece of it. Now, of course, Doug will automate this as well. You put money in your checking account or direct deposit directly to a savings account and then have money go wherever he wants it. But I'm with you. I like tax flexibility. I think both is better than either or here.
Well, yeah, sure. Do both.
No, I'm saying if he backs it down, don't back it down all the way.
Mm, yeah. A little bit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if he's eligible for a Roth, why wouldn't he go that direction?
Well, I think that he should. I mean, that's just one of those, you know, one of those areas that you have to have some balance in. You need some money that you can pull out tax-free. If you have the opportunity to do that, whether through regular contributions or non-deductible contributions and a conversion, you know, try it out. The other thing that I would also add is if you have a 403B, or I'm sorry, 457, you probably also have a 403B, and maybe that has the Roth option attached to it. You know, you said the 457 doesn't at your workplace, but maybe the 403B does. So, you know, maybe you can switch it up that way. If you're contributing to the 403B pre-tax,
yeah,
do that Roth and then do the 457 pre-tax instead. So
yeah,
there might be some flexibility there.
Great question, Doug. Thanks for the question and for the kind words. If you've got a question for us, head to stackingbenjamins.com/voicemail. And like Doug, if you've got a phone handy that has a browser, just do it on your phone and you'll press a button when you get to stackingbenjamins.com/voicemail and leave us a message. And we're happy to handle that on the show. One more thing from earlier. I was very happy to get a message from August. August said, hey, Joe and OG, listening to Train Your Brain for Better Work with Dr. Joseph Cardillo, specifically the Haven Lifeline segment about the listener who's contributed non-deductible after-tax dollars to a traditional IRA. And you and I, OG, had talked about what a mess that creates and don't do it. August writes, an approach to solving the issue of commingling pre-tax and after-tax money that was not mentioned on the show would be to roll the pre-tax funds back into a 401k, assuming that's allowed by his plan. So sometimes when you have pre-tax money sitting in an IRA, they will let you put that money back in. That would leave just the after-tax funds in the IRA, which can then be converted to Roth without incurring taxes on the pre-tax money that's been transferred out. That is a solution. Every solution to this, another messy solution, August, but definitely a solution that we didn't talk about. Great letter from August. All right, that's going to do it for today. Big thanks to everybody. We're going to let Doug, our resident genius, thank everyone.
Nobody can see the air quotes, but I see what you did there. Yeah.
I think you might have been able to hear it with the hesitation just slightly. Big thanks to lots of people, but big thanks to you especially for hanging out with us. If you've got somebody in your life who maybe is wondering about geniuses or just likes to be entertained by a guy like Dr. Craig Wright, this might be a good episode to share with them. And last but not least, OG and his team, the clock is ticking, are still just for a little bit longer accepting clients this year. So if you're looking to lock in your financial plan in 2020, you need to hurry up. StackingBenjamins.com/OG. All right. That's going to do it for now. Doug, take it from here, man. What should we have learned today?
So what should we have learned today? First, take a lesson from our headlines. Security isn't just about giving people money. It's about also providing the tools to get from consumer to saver. Second, take a lesson from Craig Wright. while you might not be a genius like me and Elon Musk, there are lots of habits you can implement to compete, be curious, ask big questions, and dive in. But the big takeaway? Turns out, according to Joe's mom, that this, quote, miracle HGH thing has a few unintended consequences, like carpal tunnel syndrome, nerve, muscle, and joint pain, swelling of the arms and legs, numb and tingling skin, and growth of cancerous tumors. Yeah, you know what? It turns out 6 feet is pretty much the perfect height. We already knew I was perfect, am I right? Hashtag Doug2020. Special thanks to Craig for joining Joe today. You can find Craig's book, The Hidden Habits of Genius, on our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. This show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Taylor Stevens, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and there's a 73% chance that I played Chuck on Happy Days. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remunerations. That's a big word. There's no way you take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial decisions, consult with a real financial advisor.
Did you have cable your entire life?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
I remember we didn't get cable till I was like 12. Time for an old guy story. But I remember we'd go over to people's houses with cable. My brother and I'd be glued to the TV. And I remember my mom even saying, you should go play with your friends. I'm like, but they've got like 100 channels. we've got to watch that. But we always had the doggy ears. You never had the antenna on the TV where
maybe for a while. I mean, I remember it.
Where you had to like try to get in the channel.
Sure.
And you turn it one way or another. Yeah. Similar situation happened in Wales recently. This is from CNN. For 18 months, residents of a village in Wales have been mystified as to why their broadband internet crashed every morning. Engineers have finally identified the reason, a secondhand television that emitted a signal that interfered with the connection. It's so great. It's just like, no, if you put the dog ears just this way, just a little more. Like there's always some little thing that you wouldn't, you know, everybody's thinking these big technology problems. Nope, not that. A crack team of engineers turned detectives and become heroes in the village of Aberhosen after finally finding the source of the problem, according to a press release from Openreach, the company that runs the UK's digital network, published Tuesday. Staff had visited the village repeatedly, found no fault with the network. They even replaced cables in the area to try to solve the problem, but to no avail. Then local engineer Michael Jones called in assistance from experts at the Openreach chief engineer team. After carrying out a plethora of tests, engineers had a theory the problem could be caused by a phenomenon called single high-level impulse noise, in which an appliance emits electrical interference that impacts broadband connectivity. They walked up and down the village in a torrential rain at 6 a.m. to see if they could locate the noise. At 7 a.m., like clockwork, the device picked up a large burst of electrical interference in the village. Turns out that Earl had this really crappy TV that was taking down everybody's internet.
Nice.
Oops. Thanks, Earl.
My bad.
As we knew, we all knew it was Earl's fault. Gonna be Earl. Well, this show's over, Stackers, but you know what? It's Military Appreciation Month, and that means that we've got time still for a shout out to members of our community, members of our family who have served our country. And you know what? Today, I want to give a shout out to two of my uncles, my Uncle Henry, who was in the Army. Let's do three. My Uncle Eddie, who was in the Army, and my Uncle Bill, also in the Army. And two of them served in Vietnam. One served in Korea. And a big thanks to all three of my uncles, my dad's brothers, who served like he did in the military. And this Military Appreciation Month, Navy Federal Credit Union wants to celebrate not just my uncles, but they want to celebrate their members who go above and beyond. Navy Federal offers member-only exclusive rates, discounts, and tools to empower their members and help them reach their goals. Of course, you may be eligible for Navy Federal membership and you don't even know it because it's open to all branches of the military, veterans, DOD employees, and their families. They're all eligible, and I want to reiterate, and their families. If you have family, like I do, who served in the military, well, then you're eligible for Navy Federal membership. Navy Federal's employees are part of the community they serve, and many of them are military family members, reservists, or veterans. Here during Military Appreciation Month, Stackers, go visit NavyFederal.org/celebrate, and you're going to see all of Navy Federal's Military Appreciation Month offers. So many cool things they're doing for veterans. You'll also see all their other awesome 24/7, 12 months of the year offers. That's NavyFederal.org/celebrate. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.